what a wonderful pleasure to see you all in the room. Welcome. Welcome on behalf of the Harvard Law School. Welcome on behalf of the Berkman Center. I should say a word about Berkman, since he is the source of largesse that makes this possible. Jack Berkman was a graduate of Harvard Law School who initially got into public radio. This is back in the late 40s, and was then one of the first to innovate with cable, stringing wires up the mountains in Pittsburgh. He fortunately sold out to Jack Malone, kept stock in TCI, and the rest is history. He had a vision that somehow technology and entrepreneurial activity should go together and infuse the academic environment. He had the feeling that prior to his action that had not been the case. And so it came to the Berkman Center to try and implement his vision in the space of internet. It's really that brings us to Dave Weiner. Dave Weiner as a Berkman Fellow. Dave Weiner is an innovator, recently the recipient of an award for being among the top 25 innovators for his principal contribution to SOAP. He is the, and I should say a word about that. That is innovation. That is interoperability. That is the idea that is, to my thought, the essential Dave Weiner, the notion that somehow in this space one acts to create, to design, to implement, and then to demonstrate interoperability. He's recently formulated what he calls the win-win rule. It's a rule that I like very much. It says, it's okay to move into this space for your own self-interest in order to benefit yourself. But along with that comes an obligation to give something back. And the give back takes the form of linkage. Linkage committed to interactivity and to truth. It's actually that theme on which I'd like to close my introduction to him. When I think of Dave and think back on historic characters that somehow resonate with what Dave Weiner means to me, I go way back to Socrates. Now think about Socrates. Socrates was this character who created new forms for interaction. He was completely committed to the idea of dialogue, of conversation. And he was so driven by truth above all other elements in his universe that he was led to take anybody on in any forum to the point where finally, and I don't predict this for you, Dave. You're waiting for that part. So, I'd like to give Dave a gift, if I may. This is a book about Socrates, about the life of Socrates, about a man who was totally committed to education, who invented a new form, who actually demonstrated its use and pioneered a new space. And so, Dave, would you come and accept this book, and would you all greet Dave Weiner?
This is great. I mean, it's called The Art of Living. And in a way, you know, somebody asked me, we have our Thursday night meetings here. Every Thursday we have a weblog writers meeting. And somebody asked, well, what do you want to accomplish at BloggerCon, thinking that, well, you know, we'd want to get some protocol or format or whatever established. I said, no, if we can just sort of have some human contact, exchange some ideas, get to know a few more people, get a sense or a feel for what this blogosphere thing is, I would be very happy. I'd feel like we've accomplished a tremendous amount. And so, Charlie, thank you very much. A beautiful, beautiful introduction. Also, thank you for your welcome at Berkman. It's been a major, major thing for me. I mean, I get to work with, this is a place that has a philosophy. This is a place that believes in freedom. I've met some of Chris Lydon, Jim Moore, are also Berkman fellows here. I've met some of the best people I've ever worked with. And so I welcome all of you to Harvard University. Welcome you to BloggerCon 2003. And, you know, let's have a great time. So now, I want to talk just a little bit about our network situation here and acknowledge that it's probably not working for you, okay? And I'm going to ask you to sort of look through that, and let's not have the conference be about net connections, okay? Right? Because I'm sure with the brains that are in this room, we could probably by the end of the day get every computer connected. But I think we have more important things that we want to work on today. So pray to the computer gods and hope for the best. And by the end of the day, or maybe if Murphy willing, substantially before that, we'll all have our net connections and we'll be able to blog this conference. So let me give you a little idea of, also if you have problems with your computer, see Erin. She's out at the reception desk outside, right outside that door. She's wearing a blue sweater, and she knows her way around the network here, and she can help you. So, first I wrote up some ground rules for the conference, and I want to make sure they're very clear so people understand, especially the first one, is that everything anyone says here is on the record and for attribution. So, if you want in a one-on-one conference, now it certainly goes with anything that's said on stage or any comment or question that happens in the audience. Obviously, the thing is being webcast, so you know anybody is going to be able to hear what you say and record. It also goes in private one-on-one conversations you have with people. So if you want it to be private and not on the record, be sure to say so and be sure to get agreement. The reason for this is that there are a lot of reporters in the room, professional reporters in the room today, and then there are also a lot of amateur reporters because it's a blogging conference, right? And so rather than have on the record be the exception, I want it on the record to be the rule. Another one is this is a users conference. So fundamental difference in approach. Most conferences that are somehow about technology are conferences where the vendors get up on stage and they talk to the users and they explain things to the users and the users do what they're supposed to do, which usually, I don't want to go there. This one's different, okay? We do have vendors present, right? But the vendors are in the audience. And we're here to talk about how this technology is used. So our focus is on blogging in journalism, blogging in education, blogging in politics, and blogging in specifically presidential politics. So we're looking at uses primarily. Another ground rule, let's not debate whether or not blogs are journalism. Right. I mean, I think we can settle that one right off the bat. Blogs are journalism, and blogs aren't journalism. You know, it's like saying, is a telephone journalism? Kind of a silly question. A telephone can certainly be used in the practice of journalism, or it can be used in the practice of anything but journalism. So, think of it as an instrument. Let's not debate that. I don't think those debates go anywhere. And so I ask you, let's not put that into question. However, the question of what is a weblog is very much on topic. I've been to conferences where people were told that it's not a good question, it's not an interesting question. But we don't really know the answer to this question, and it seems kind of important. And since we are in an academic setting, we do care about things like that. So if we come out of this conference with an absolute rock-solid definition of a weblog, which I kind of doubt that we will have made enormous progress, in my opinion. So are there any questions or comments about that? Anybody have anything to say? We'll introduce the people. We have microphone monitors here. We do this a little differently than other conferences you may have attended. We don't use these stands here. I find that when people line up at the microphones, they compose speeches in their heads, they get nervous. When the microphone, they finally get the chance to talk, what comes out is gobbledygook and gibberish. So what I want is, when you have something to say, grab the attention of either Michael Feldman or Chris Lydon over here. Chris, would you raise your hand so everybody knows you? And they'll come to you with a microphone. They're going to hold the microphone, okay? You don't get to hold it, all right? That means that if somebody groans, they can use their judgment, right, and say, okay, let's move this on, right? They're both very smart, very kind people. And, you know, we're operating sort of in the interest of the entire audience. We're all participants here and trying to keep things moving very quickly. So grab their attention when you have something to say. And I think basically this is kind of up for grabs as far as the moderators are concerned, that, you know, a comment, in my opinion, is always welcome. But you don't have to, if you're a moderator, you don't have to recognize somebody at any given moment. The idea here, though, is to view this as a discussion. It's not a bunch of people standing up here talking to you and you waiting to ask questions of them. It's a discussion. And we're here to learn not just in this direction, but sort of in every direction. Okay? Because look around you. These are some absolutely incredible people you're sitting there with. So what we want to do is we want to make sure we can learn from everybody. So I'm going to take 5 minutes now, just quickly run through some ideas that I jotted down, things that I think if we at any moment run out of things to talk about, we might want to talk about, okay? These are just things that I think are hot topics in the world of weblogs right now. And then I'm going to turn it over to, where's Ed Cohn?
I'm right here.
Has everybody arrived?
Everybody's
here. Okay. Then I'm going to turn it over to Ed and the journalism panel, and that'll be an hour and a half. And I think we have a breakout, but I'll have to look at the schedule. And then sometime this morning, is Len Apkar here? Len? No, not yet. Okay. We have a two-person interview with a blogger. It'll happen sometime later today. Either in the morning with James Taranto. James, raise your hand. There's James. James is from the Wall Street Journal. He does the What's on the Web. What's the name of the column?
Best of the Web,
right, on the Wall Street Journal, which is kind of like a weblog. And James Taranto, or is a weblog, we'll find out, right? And James Taranto is the editor-in-chief of NewYorkTimes.com. And both, by their presence, are indicating, I guess, that they're interested in blogs. And so the thing that seems to be the hot topic, now I'm going to go into the sort of quick recital of the hot topics. Editing. How much editing can you do on a weblog? In other words, how many people? I mean, I've tried to write a definition, my own definition of a weblog, the unedited voice of a person, and within minutes somebody said, well, what do you mean by edited? And, you know, what if there are two people? And, you know, okay, all these questions come up. Somehow in there's a concept. There's a difference between the editorial product of a professional news organization and the editorial product of a blog, when you view a blog as an editorial product. What is that? So we're going to look at that. Does it make sense for the New York Times to have a weblog? Doc Searles, where's Doc? Doc's right here. Doc, you said it was oxymoronic, right? Or you didn't, somebody said that. You said a blog wouldn't, did you not say that?
Yeah, and I just said I did not think the New York Times was a blog, and the New York Times is a newspaper.
Okay, there's one point of view. Now, New York Magazine, no, and yeah, I'm sorry, Doc, I love you, right? I mean, I didn't mean to, okay, good.
The New York Times is not a newspaper. The New York Times is a newspaper and a website and a TV channel.
Okay. That's more closer, That's closer to my point of view. I think the New York Times would make an excellent weblog.
Okay, but what I was saying was that it came from being a newspaper first.
Yes.
And I was trying to shift the subject to something else that was my agenda, so that's a whole other subject.
Okay, and that's okay. We do that here. We do that here. We shift things to our agendas at will. That's totally okay. Right. Now, and New York Magazine. Pardon me? Oh, so were you. And who are you? Who are you? Oh, Len, nice to meet you. Excellent. Okay. Oh, when I asked...
I'm not going to have to mark myself on the blog.
And I might point out that the New York Magazine now has a weblog, so we're one word away from the New York Times having a weblog. Okay. Now, another idea, think of this as a weblog, okay? got a bunch of bloggers in the room. When the microphone comes to you, think of that as a pointer. You know, think about how conferences and blogs sort of share philosophy. How would the blog philosophy apply to a conference, and how would it change it? You're at a conference. We do lots of conferences every year. Can we come out of this with some concrete ideas about how conferences can be done better? And I don't doubt that we can do that. We're going to talk about the second superpower, which is a concept that Jim Moore, my colleague at Berkman, pioneered or authored or created or invented, however you want to look at it, resonated hugely with people. Really, really sort of grabbed them somewhere, and it seemed to fly on its own. So, you know, the blogs, in the panel that Chris will lead, we're going to look at, which is called Clutrain 2003. And by the way, we have three of the four Clutrain authors here in the room with us. Doc, David Weinberg, would you raise your hand? I don't know where Chris hasn't got here. Chris Locke is also here. So we'll talk about that. And it seems like on that panel, you've got a lot of ideas that seem to lead to weblogs. Like business, that's the Clutrain manifesto. I've said to Doc, and I think he agrees, that weblogs are sort of the implementation of the Clutrain philosophy. You know, it's how do you become transparent to the world so that when people want to find out about your company, you actually participate in that conversation. They're not just talking about you. You're actually talking about yourself, and people are caring. Well, in order to do that, my bet was and still is that weblog philosophy is very much part of the way you're going to approach it. And I also want to do a hat tip to David. His interview with Chris Lydon led to my writing those two rules. It was good to be reminded that back in, for me, in 1994, which is when I got into the web, that it was for very idealistic reasons. It's because I believed in its ability to create connections to great people, okay? And, you know, in preparing for this conference, and a large part of the preparation for the conference were the interviews that Chris did, I asked him, hey, you know, go around to all the sort of leading lights of the blogging community and wander far afield, you know, go wherever it leads you. And I heard, in a few of the cases, this same idealism. And it was amazing to me that through all the years of, I have had cynical years, I've had great years, then I've gone back to cynicism, you know, tried it all, you know. After, through the whole thing, there's been this sort of streak of idealism that seems to come along with weblogs. Another thing, Chris and I were driving up to New Hampshire to go see one of the candidates, I forget which one, and we were talking about a mutual friend of ours who is very interested in money, and so the question was, should this guy come to BloggerCon or not? And I thought about it. I said, well, will we be talking about money at BloggerCon? And then I reviewed in my mind the sort of people who are speaking here. No, I don't think we're going to be talking about money. I don't think any of these people are very, any of us, I don't want to ask for that. I was going to ask, raise your hand if you're focused on money, but that's a hard question. Oh, well, I think you've come to the wrong place. Maybe at some point, BloggerCon 2030, maybe there will be money on the table or whatever. Maybe 2004, you don't know. One thing's for sure is presidential politics is on the table. I don't know, is Cameron Barrett in the room? Cameron hasn't arrived yet, okay. Well, I was going to introduce him and embarrass him. I will get to introduce him later. Cameron was one of the first bloggers. He started in 1997. On the way, he went to Siberia, and a couple of weeks ago, he surfaced as the chief blogger of the Wesley Clark campaign for president. And so, an amazing sort of process that leads somebody to start a blog in 1997 when you could count the number of blogs on, you know, your hands and your toes, your fingers and your toes. And now here it is 2003 when we have like 4 million blogs or something like that. And one of the original guys is doing the weblog for the guy who might be the next president of the United States. So another thought is, well, or question for all of you to consider is, what is the Dean phenomenon about? We witnessed something there, okay? Well, because, and somehow that was connected internet presidential politics, but what was the connection? Was it the blogging world finding a presidential candidate and pumping money into them, or was it a politician who understood the internet, or was it something somewhere between, or something completely different? And then, what's the next step? Now, in my opinion, Dean, interesting start, but to make it really sort of, you know, explosive, to change the political system in a way that blogs, I think, want to change the political system, the equation's going to flip around, and you're going to find that voters are running the weblogs, and the politicians, the candidates, are benefiting from that by having a better understanding of the voters. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're making, I was talking with Josh Marshall last night, and it was remarkable, we both thought it was remarkable, and I think anybody observing it would think it's remarkable, how much progress has been made in such an incredibly short period of time, how important blogs have become to the American political situation. So can you extrapolate that they will become more important over the coming months that lead to presidential election? I think it's a no-brainer to extrapolate they'll become more important. We're all kind of lucky in a way that because of timing or whatever, we may get to influence how that happens. So think seriously, because the people who are here and they're listening, and, you know, so. All right, so that's about it. I want to briefly, Ed, could you bring your people up? And I'll, while you're doing that, I'll talk a little bit about how I got to know you, and I'll be very brief about it. Ed, I can. Ed's a friend. All the moderators I consider friends. I ask people who I really connect with to do, you know, to moderate these panels. I trust him. I've known him for just a few years. I've watched him. He's a relatively new blogger, but I've watched him. He wrote a one-year piece, one-year retrospective, after having blogged for 1 year, and it read like an anthem for blogging. It was, he nailed it, probably better than anybody I had seen. So I said, okay, Ed, what is journalism? Tell me about journalism and weblogs. And he put together this panel, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Ed, now. Thanks very much.
How are we doing?
All right. We're all sitting down.
There's three, you know, I'll sit on the end.
Okay.
Just introduce my guys real quick.
You got it.
Excuse me.
Let me plug myself in here.
Plug yourself in. He's a cyborg. And my name is Ed Cohn. I have a website cleverly named edcohn.com. My panel is, this panel is on weblogs and journalism. And now that I hear we're not going to debate whether weblogs are journalism, I don't know what the hell we're going to talk about, but I guess it'll be on the practice of journalism via weblog. To my left, physically, is Glenn Reynolds, better known as Instapundit, the Dirk Diggler of Hit Count. To his left, Scott Rosenberg, Salon, a guy who's been doing web journalism for so long that he still has stock options that he thinks might be worth something. And to his left, Dr. Josh Marshall, whose Talking Points memo, I think we'll start with, and I'm going to sit down and shut up. What Josh does, I think, is very interesting, or has done a lot of, is the very basic job of our craft of journalism, which is reporting. We do a lot of punditry, we do a lot of commenting on what other people write, but Josh, as much as anybody, I think, has reported stories, broken stories, done interviews, and put them on his weblog. Most recently, he did an interview with General Wesley Clark, and he posted it on his weblog. And so, I guess my first question for Josh would be, you got this interview with Wesley Clark, it's one of the hot interviews. You could have put it a lot of places. Why did you put it on your weblog, and why was he willing to go on your weblog rather than insist that you put it in some more traditional venue?
Is this picking up?
Just talking up.
I mean, the whole point was for it to be on the weblog. That was certainly why they came to me. So on their side, it wasn't a matter of that they wanted to, you know, would have wanted me to publish it in some of the other venues that I, you know, that I write in. The whole point was that they wanted it there. I mean, I don't think it's any secret. It seemed obvious to me that, you know, they're just getting into the campaign. obviously the Dean campaign is sort of, you know, one of their things is they're so internet savvy and they've got all the online fundraising and the blog and stuff like that, and I think this was a way for them to, you know, attempt to sort of leapfrog or kind of get into that game, that they're internet savvy, they're using the sort of latest web technology and stuff like that. For my part, you know, I do various freelance stuff. I write a weekly column in one of the Capitol Hill newspapers. I write for a political magazine in Washington called the Washington Monthly. I'm much more invested in my website than in any of those other other places that pay me money to write for them. So it was never a question. I mean, that's obviously that's my thing. That's sort of what I'm associated with. So even though maybe I could have made a little money, you know, kind of selling it, there was never any question in my mind. I mean, it, more and more, I mean, I've been doing the site for almost 3 years now. And when I first started it, I mean, when the hit count was so low, there was kind of a question in my mind if I would get a big story or an interview or something like that. Would I use it for the site? Would I take it somewhere else? And obviously, there's both a professional and a money question, frankly. And not long after I started my site, I quit my job, and so I was just freelancing. So the money question was a cute one for a good year or so. But over time, I have that question less and less. I mean, almost everything I get that's a scoop, kind of a big story, I do it for the site, partly because I can control when it comes out. And one of the things that you hate as any kind of journalist, especially in some ways as a freelance journalist, is that, you know, in the process of selling a story to a publication, someone else gets it, which is you know, mortifying on any number of levels.
Somebody else what?
Gets it. Someone gets to it first. Someone scoops you. Someone gets the story first.
Right.
And then you're out of luck completely. But also over time, as it has more, as the site got more traffic, a bigger audience, it for professionally speaking, for me, there was no downside to having me be on the site. So that's an interesting question.
Well, you lead in. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I had a question. You know, I noticed that you did a great job on your site of taking that whole little story about Wes Clark having said that Karl Rove had returned his phone calls, right, he would have been a Republican. And right. You sort of took right. that and did a nice little sort of debunking of that. Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense that the Clark people then turned to you because they thought you were somehow friendly or, you know?
Probably. I mean, that whole interview, I think the first time it was, actually did the interview on Tuesday. I think the first communication I had with them was on Sunday. So it all came about pretty quickly. I'd obviously written things about him that yeah, sure they saw me as someone who'd be at least not hostile. So yeah, sure that was a big part of it. I'm sure none of that got said explicitly, but it was sort of obvious to me.
Now, I'm very interested, I think all of us, most of us are interested in this idea of building an audience. If you're the New York Times, you have a built-in brand name. In terms of building an audience, Josh, you were involved in the Trent Lott story. Scott, you've got Salon behind you. But the champ, the man who does more hits than Adam Curry in Amsterdam coffee houses, Glenn Reyes. Glenn, I asked you, and it was sort of dispiriting to me. I said, Glenn, how do you build the biggest media brand in independent media? How do you build hit count? And you kind of said, I don't know. So that's very upsetting. No, but 9/11 was your moment that you seized. Can you talk a little bit about how that grew and how your site grew?
It was kind of viral, and it was a total surprise. I mean, I teach internet law, so I sort of try to find something new to do on the internet now and then, and I've done some internet music sites and stuff before that, and I thought a blog would be kind of cool, and I had the ambition that, you know, if I did a pretty good job, I could have a couple of hundred kind of high-quality readers that would make it worth doing. And actually, I have to say, traffic took off pretty fast. The only thing I did that you could call marketing was that in the early days, I would, if I wrote something about a story, I would email the reporter or the pundit or whoever I was writing something about and let them know I'd mentioned it. And that did work. I remember, in fact, I wrote something about something on Salon, and this was back when I actually could spot individual people in my thing. And I noticed about 30 minutes later, after I wrote whoever the author was, I think it was Damien Cave, I got a bunch of hits from Salon.com. You know, I said, oh, that's what people really do follow this. And it grew faster even before 9/11 than I really expected. I had like 1,600 page views the day September 10th, and I thought I was just, you know, in high cotton. And then it did take off after that. And I think that's because other sites linked to me more. I mean, I think that's really, it's just a viral thing. I think every time somebody links to you, you get a certain number of readers, and most of them look at you and kind of go, okay, and they go away and they never come back. But some of them accrete. And I think there was a lot of word of email involved, too. But a lot of people have asked me, you know, what was your marketing plan? What's your business plan? And I never had one. I think, you know, there's actually a style of planning, I'm told, that fits that. It's called surfing, and that's where you go out there and you paddle around and wait for the wave to pick you up and carry you where you're going. And I guess that's what I did. The only thing I've done, I guess, that people like Jeff Jarvis think is helpful is I just link to a lot of people. And I know there's this school of thought, and you see it less and less among web bloggers, and I'm happy to say you can see it less and less with big media people, but there is a school of thought that if you link to other people, people might like them better. It reminds me of Ted Baxter. I remember that he wouldn't go on vacation because he was afraid they might like the replacement anchor better than him. And so he tried to get him to just rerun the film of his old newscast. Oh, the news doesn't change that much. And this whole sort of keep people on your site theory seems to me to sort of reek of Ted Baxter style insecurity. And I think, you know, when people find that you send them to places that are more interesting than you, they may come back to you, not for your sake, but for the sake of the people you point them to. And I suspect that's pretty much why people come to me, because I'm not really that interesting a guy, but I do seem to be able to find interesting people, and I think that's really all there is.
Well, you can get, you know, how many page views a day?
Yeah, around 100,000.
100,000 by just writing the word "indeed" after something that somebody else. it's
how I do it,
though. It's a hell of an "indeed." Scott, you have a different sort of way to build traffic and to reach an audience. That is, you're working within an organization. I know we're going to talk about editing and about sort of professional blogging, but how is that, or is it at all different from practicing journalism on the purest of freelance basis? As these guys are doing.
Yeah. Well, as organizations go, Salon is about as, you know, sort of unbureaucratic and unstratified as you can get. I mean, from where I sit, it's a little hard to talk about that. I think that, you know, the larger question that seems to be on people's minds is that we have this thing called blogging, which is inherently individualistic and inherently, disruptive of hierarchy. And then we have these very hierarchical, very established media organizations looking at them and saying, you know, what's here? This is kind of exciting. This is kind of cool. What can we do with it? And so they're excited and they're also afraid because they are hierarchical and they are invested mostly in the idea that the individual is subordinate to the organization. You know, at Salon, I'm lucky. I wear several hats. I am an editor and a writer. And as the managing editor, I'm sort of free to say, well, you know, I'm going to do a blog. I'm going to say what I want. And, the organization is not worried about me saying something that is sort of going to disrupt it because, you know, I'm one of the key members of the organization. I think Salon being the kind of place it is, we don't have any problem particularly with the idea of giving writers, letting the writer hold the mic. We were talking about holding the mic before. An interesting case in point, Joe Connison writes a daily journal for us, which isn't quite a blog, but it's almost a blog. It's sufficiently blog-like to qualify for this discussion.
we offered to him to say, we said, hey, you know, you can just kind of do this and post this stuff yourself. We can show you how to do it. And he said, no, you know what? Good to have an editor review it. That's how I'm used to working. Let me do it that way. And so we actually edited his stuff. So a lot of writers actually, and particularly people who are used to doing, you know, professional or organizational journalism, actually want to be edited. You know, it sort of gives them a backstop. It helps them make sure that they've got things right. Lets them bounce their ideas off one other brain before sort of shipping them out to the public. Some writers actually prefer to work that way. So that the whole editing question, it's not simply a black and white, you know, let the individual spirit free, don't edit me, don't fret on me kind of thing.
Well, I mean, working without a net is kind of scary. I'm sure we've all felt that you put something out there and it is a little scary. But that sort of new frontier is very interesting to me. One of the most tired questions about weblogs and journalism is always positing an either-or, that it's either weblogs or the mainstream media. I had an experience last week where I did something that the mainstream media can't do. I went to a shareholders meeting of a public company that was closed to the press. You can't close a shareholders meeting anymore because every shareholder is a potential journalist. You can't close Baghdad anymore because Salam Fox is there. And I'll just throw this for you guys or for anybody. What are some of the places that weblogs are going to take journalism that are closed to journalism now and that will extend the reach of journalism and of journalists? And that will, I think, lead to maybe some ethical questions about what we can and can't cover with our weblogs. Everything's on the record here. Everything isn't on the record elsewhere. But where else can we go? Baghdad, shareholder meetings?
I mean, when you said that, I mean, just because of what I do, I mean, I thought in terms of presidential campaigns. And you know, obviously, I think it'll allow journalists to do a little more of the, you know, kind of Hunter S. Thompson sort of, you know, just tagging along with campaigns and stuff like that. But also, I mean, you know, in any given campaign locale, you're going to have people who have their own blogs. And I just, the way my mind works, I mean, that issue of what's on the record and what's not. I mean, I think I really think in those terms, as, you know, working as a journalist, that there's certain things where, certain contexts where you can repeat things that people say, and there's others you can't. And you know, I think a lot of people who aren't journalists who do blogs don't think in those terms. You know, I saw it, I did see it, it happened. I didn't break in, so I'm going to tell everybody else. And I can understand that, but just I'm not sure how that plays out exactly.
I think it could have a real downside. I mean, I remember Irving Goffman, the sociologist, wrote about the importance of what he called the backstage, you know, the place where you're able to say the things that you're not supposed to say in public. And that's not just psychologically valuable to people, though it is, but that, in fact, a lot of institutions really can't function without a backstage. And I don't think weblogs are going to be the cause of this, because I think the backstage has pretty much vanished over, he wrote that in like 1962 or something like that, but it's been vanishing for a long time anyway, but I think this is just the next stage in that trend, that you really, you know, the whole notion of closing things to the press is meaningless now. But to me, the big breakthrough in blogging this election is actually a little-noted event, but it's the guy who does that ninedwarfs.com blog out of Iowa, which was trying to get his picture made with all the Democratic candidates, and Kerry's campaign was running from him. And, in fact, it instructed everybody, you know, keep this guy away from him, don't let him ask any questions, don't let him get close enough to get a picture. And I thought, you know, what a presidential campaign's biggest press worry is a blogger who's had a blog for, at that time, 3 weeks. This guy can email me. I've got this Nine Dwarfs blog about the candidates in Iowa. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I looked at it. Well, I didn't think any more of it until I found out that Kerry's campaign was running scared. And, you know, in a way, that shows Kerry's campaign really got blogging more than maybe they've gotten credit for. their response may have been poor. But I mean, I thought that was really quite a dramatic moment, in that you used to be worried about Hunter S. Thompson, or you used to be worried about, you know, some famous journalist catching you, and now you're worried about some guy whose name I can't even remember. You know, with a blog you started 3 weeks ago.
I think that the backstage area that you know, blogs are kind of already doing the most to bring out is the backstage of journalism itself. And that's, you know, in a way been its most disruptive
impact. So you start with something like Jim Romanesco's site, which became a kind of a focal point for media coverage, even though it's largely uncommented on. He doesn't have a whole lot of editorial or personal commentary himself on the links he posts, but just by having one place that sort of the entire spectrum of coverage of media was concentrated, and then opening up a letters page, a simple thing, not even a comments thread. Now he has comments threads, but for the longest time it was just a letters page. That simple little, opening of a window an inch, I think made a huge difference. And over time, of course, now we have a whole blogosphere of people writing about what's happening inside their newspapers or inside their magazines. The impact there, I think, is huge in that publications have always had this kind of we're going to make our decisions and then ship these out to you people and you, our audience, and let you kind of digest it, let you consume it after we've digested it. The way that that's changed now, I don't personally, I sort of agree a little bit more maybe with Doc in the discussion earlier about, should the New York Times have weblogs? I'm very, dedicated to reading my New York Times as it is. I think despite, all the recent hoorah and Jason Blair and all that, it's still a great newspaper. I read it every morning. I want it to be what it is. I don't want it to become a blog. But I do think that the impact of blogs in this area is that an institution like the New York Times is forced to become more transparent or more blog-like as an institution. It doesn't start publishing blogs, it just needs to open itself up a little more, and it already has. I noticed that several weeks after the Blair affair, we saw this thing on the New York Times letters page. Some of you probably saw it, where the person who selects the letters wrote this essay, "How I Select the Letters." This was an extraordinary thing. The New York Times that I grew up reading 25 years ago would never have done that. You weren't supposed to know. That's a huge change. And it's a simple change, but I think that is the kind of thing we're going to see more and more of.
You're wielding a microphone. Do you have a reason to wield that microphone? Have a question? Okay.
We've got two mics right here. Anybody wants to
comment on what was last said? On the radio on the way up, I was just hearing some interviews of John Lennon, who was talking about the Satyricon days of the Beatles, when it was a pretty wild party, but the press kept it quiet because they didn't want to lose the access to the free drinks and all the Satyricon benefits. They said that that ability to disclose what was going on backstage was used as leverage by people who wanted to gain access to John Lennon and the Beatles at all hours of the day or night. And so this opening up may cut off certain avenues for special interests to gain leverage to folks with inside information. Just a common observation.
Well, that's interesting, but the flip side of that, I would think, is that it's opened up to everybody. Once again, everybody who can publish onto the web is now a potential source. Your butler, I think Frank Sinatra's valet just wrote a book. I don't think he'd wait 20 years now to write a book.
They were sources before, though.
Right.
Those people, the insiders, were sources for journalists.
Right.
Before.
They did. Right.
I'm not sure that anything changed there. Do you think something changed?
Well, I think it's just that it's not just the insiders. Everybody has access to write it in real time, and that's huge. But to me, it raises a lot of probably legal issues as well as ethical issues. I know. Gilmore gets some crap from Dave for not covering the inside of his newspaper, but I got to tell you, the people who write my paycheck, when I get news from Ziff Davis Media, I don't put it on my weblog until it's appeared in another publication, because I think I have a legal obligation. I know I have an ethical obligation to be part of a team. So I think it raises. People are going to get in a lot of trouble.
I'd like you to explore this. These guys. The question is basically, you have bloggers or people who say that they're bloggers that are inside big media companies, right? Fact, right? Do we learn any more about big media companies as a result of that? I don't think we do. So, what is it going to take to get the media companies to to let us inside and see how they work. We can infer how they work, by the way. We're not stupid, right?
Do we learn more about the University of Tennessee Law School?
Because
we
have the University of Tennessee Law
School. I care about it. A lot of people care about it.
It's germane to this. We don't care. The University of Tennessee Law School doesn't control the information I get, okay? But Viacom does. Knight Ridder does. Jeff Jarvis does.
But Dave, I think what you're looking for is blog is essentially personal. And you're looking for the institution to become a blogger. It can't.
I'm not saying that Dan Gilmore has to do this. I've never said that, right, Dan? But I've asked a question about how we're going to, is it definitional?
Individual. That some person is maybe going to tell you how the organization works. I'm always dancing that line. When I talk about journalism, I'm working for a big institution, and I've got to be a little careful, and I'm not going to really reveal my institution's ways. But you're going to see how one person inside the institution thinks, same as you do with Dan.
Same here. Listen, I've got the problem now, too, okay? When I write, and it could conceivably be construed as speaking for the institution that I work for, I have to get approval, okay? I have to get my ass covered. I can't go out there and speak on behalf of the university, or else they're going to kick my ass, right? So, I understand that. But there
is... As individuals, you start to learn the organization.
But universities are wonderfully transparent at times. But media companies are not.
So it's not a black and white situation. You're not going to hear about details of the New York Times or the Washington Post boardroom business from their columnists. But on the spectrum from impersonality to personality, you're going to start to see more individuals inside these media institutions presenting themselves as individuals, and they may agree or disagree with their institutions. To the extent that the institutions are healthy, they will welcome this, and they will sort of encourage the individuals to express themselves and disagree and whatnot. To the extent the institutions are unhealthy, they'll punish these people, they'll fire them, and they'll lose their talent, and hopefully, in an optimistic view, they will have trouble as a result. In a pessimistic view, they'll crush these voices and continue in their closed ways.
I mean, one of the things there's different ways to think about what's an institution. I mean, I don't have a job, so I don't really work for an institution per se. But one of the things I try to do.
Well,
thank you.
Your
personal
reputation is your institution.
Okay. Well, but what I've tried to do from the beginning of the time I started the site is write about things that are being discussed within basically the Washington Press Corps, but aren't getting published. And that's actually been, I would say, the times that have been the most challenging for me doing the site is, if everybody, if all the journalists in Washington kind of know something and no one's talking about it, I mean, I'm enough of a populist to think that, more people should know that. I mean, if we all kind of know this, let's get it out there. On the other hand, just as an example with this current scandal that's sort of brewing down in Washington, a lot of people think that the vice president's chief of staff is the guy.
Scooter Libby,
right. And I've already written this on the site, so I'm not saying anything new here. But I knew that this was already a strong consensus. Yet, as a journalist, everybody thinking it, it's the classic thing. It's just a rumor. I mean, in a sense, it's just a rumor. And yet, the reality that all the journalists, through their own context, think this is a fact in itself, and for me at least, for what I do, that's the most challenging because it's sort of both. There are different ways to sort of justify it to yourself, but it's also it could also easily become a slippery slope because you could just say, well, everybody's saying this, I'm just going to kind of get it out there, and then that's sort of no better than publishing something.
Well, and that gets to the question of journalistic standards, which I think we're going to come back to, but.
Debbie Wild with Publishing Reports and Report. This really goes back to what Josh was saying. Which capital level paper do you write for? Both of them?
The Hill.
You said that the stories that are really important to you, it sounds like the ones that are really news, go on your site, on your blog. And my question is,
think it's true. It's certainly true for me in the sense that the things that I, the stuff that I write that actually breaks news is almost always on the site. I mean, you know, just as an example, the column I write for The Hill published on Wednesday. I file it Monday, except when I'm lazy and I file it Tuesday morning. But let's say that on paper I file it Monday. That's two, you know, that's 2 days. If I have something that's really hot, I figure it'll probably, someone else is going to beat me to it. And it's an opinion column too, so it's not really a column that's designed for breaking news. But for me, it's certainly the case, and I think it's you know, there are various publications like the New Republic has a blog and stuff like that. When they, and I know the guys who run that, and when they have something, they're going to get it up there first, just because no one wants to get scooped.
How does an independent weblogger keep from cannibalizing their own work to the point that they don't have anything left to get paid for? And those of us who haven't already sold our software companies often do think about money, and it's very, very important for those of us who are trying to feed children and dogs. And yet you have this problem, that your best stuff goes to your mistress, as it were, and you have a wife at home, or at least I do, your web blogger. How do you do that? I mean, Glenn, you, and I would say, by the way, I think other institutions are hugely important in the question of blogging, not just media. Media reflects on itself, but University of Tennessee Law School, Yale, having huge disputes with its workers, Chapel Hill, same thing. The role of these amateur journalists within institutions, I think, is one we could spend another hour and a half on. But how do you marshal your time and your intellectual resources so that you are doing your day job and you're getting paid? And how do you know when to quit blogging, which for you seems never.
For me, well, for me, the beauty is I'm a professor, and as a professor, my job consists of pretty much whatever I choose to call my job. And that's really one of the great things about my line of work. And actually, there's a sort of separate argument among the professor bloggers about whether blogging is scholarship. And I tend to think it's not, but Jack Balkin says it is, and I asked him to please send a note to my dean on saying that, just for the record. Actually, my dean thinks it is, somewhat to my surprise. Though I'm not sure I agree. For me, it's kind of, I mean, when you read some of the stories people have written about Instapundit, it sounds like I put down my plow and picked up a modem one day. I wrote books, and I wrote stuff for The Post and Wall Street Journal and places occasionally. It was all pretty much punditry, not reporting, which is really what I do. And I occasionally dabble in reporting. Either I'll call somebody up to confirm something, which may be bizarre. Once, for example, there was an NPR story in which a congressman was describing how his district ran underwater, and his voice bubbled as he talked about the underwater part. And I thought the engineers at NPR had done this. I thought, you know, this is kind of a breach of journalist ethics. So I called him and said, no, I actually talked to him. I said, no, he does that. He makes his voice do that. It's a sound. So I put a little thing about it. So, you know, that's what it is. And, sometimes it's a little more serious than that. Now, I have totally blown journalistic scoops. Some of you may be familiar with the Bell Labs scandal, and somebody who worked at Bell Labs emailed me all the dirt on that over a week before it appeared in the New York Times. And I just didn't go with it because I wasn't comfortable enough that I could confirm it. I didn't know the source well enough. It was stuff that, if it were false, would clearly have been libelous, and I think it would probably have been reckless of me to publish it. When I see a guy who identifies himself only as godless capitalist sent me the following. The fact is, it was all perfect. You know, it was absolutely right. And if I'd run with it, I would have been libel proof because it was totally true.
And we went with it.
But,
it was a different source, but we got the story.
But y'all have lawyers,
yeah,
too. I mean, that's, I think bloggers, the first big blogger lawsuit is going to be very interesting because it's going to put a real chill.
Tell Charlie about that, Charlie. You're a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer, that's why I didn't publish it.
But most amateur, look, I'm a journalist and I have fear of lawyers bred into me. But a lot of people out here are going to be journalists, and they're not going to have any safety net. And I my guess is somebody's going to get the hell suit out of them.
Actually, as long as you don't get money, you don't get paid for it. You can get libel insurance through your homeowner's policy that would probably cover a blog, and it's really cheap. But
that may be the most important thing you hear all day.
Exactly.
Homeowner's policy, be a writer.
I'm Amy Gold, and I'm a computer industry analyst, so I publish a something that you would not consider big media at all, and I also run a weblog.
Right.
It has occurred to me that one of the problems that people face, whether they're writing a business weblog like a Microsoft employee does, or whether they're doing what I do and deciding which thing to publish where, or whether you work for a big newspaper and do the same thing, there's this interesting problem that occurs, which is, how do you decide which thing goes where? And how do you explain to people who ask you, which I get asked about all the time, are you going to publish this in your weblog or are you going to publish this in your newsletter? Because the audiences I have for those two things, although we link both of them together, turn out to be really quite different. And I find that trying to explain that to people is not as simple and straightforward as I'd like it to be. How do you handle that?
I don't see it as a real either or for me. I write a newspaper column, and if I have something good, I put it in my weblog, and if it looks good 2 days later, I put it in my newspaper column, and it may be self-plagiarism, but I feel also that you have to tell your source, you have to explain to people, and that was my question to Josh. What do you tell Wesley Clark? I mean, how do you decide where to put it, and also how do you deal with people? I don't think there's a rule for that. I'm actually don't blog about my day job subject very much. I don't really write much business and technology on my weblog because I have somebody paying me for that. And I do feel that Ziff Davis owns that little part of my soul, or rents it. And that if I find something out that is useful to my magazine, even if it isn't on my beat or for a story I'm doing, I'm calling my editor up and saying, hey, do y'all know this? We ought to be covering this. So I think everybody is going to have to figure that one out for their individual weblogs. But I think the key is that you tell people. And this gets to a point that I've promised to keep getting back to. I was talking to Oliver Willis about it before. And that is, what, you know, journalistic ethics are sometimes seen as an oxymoron. But what is the ethical requirement of a weblog journalist, somebody who's not a professional journalist? And I was duking it out with Glenn earlier this week. I was saying he had a responsibility to write about something that he'd written about one side of, and the tide was turning, and doesn't he owe it to people? And I think that's a great question for people. What is the responsibility of a weblog?
Frame the question, go into it. Let's understand what the question is.
In the specific case, we were talking about reporting on people who are skeptical of claims of the administration of the need to go to war, and now we have this scandal in Washington that suddenly doesn't look so good for some of those claims, or at least for some of the politics around those claims. So I'm busting Glenn's chops and, you know, trying to get people to think, not necessarily personally disagreeing with Glenn. I'm saying, look, you're calling reporters who oppose the war fifth columnists. Now you have somebody who's alleged to have done something that George Bush Sr. has described as treason. Don't you need to write about that? And Glenn,
written about 3,000 words about it at that point. But that's the lesser question.
Right.
The bigger question is, you know, whether you have a responsibility to opine. And I guess, I think you have a responsibility to opine honestly. I don't think you have a responsibility to have an opinion.
Should we read anything into your lack of statement about this?
Well, as I said earlier, I was quite confused. The plane thing broke, which is what this is all about. And I posted on it early on. It actually broke while I was on vacation and rarely not blogging. And when I got back, I put up a link that said, I don't know much about this, but Tom McGuire's got a chronology. And then it sort of faded away. And I think I had a link to something Josh wrote about it once. But I when it came back, and I still don't understand it.
I don't understand.
Yeah, I think it's clear nobody understands.
No, I don't understand that. I don't understand.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, that defies comprehension.
Oh, okay.
Because it's so straightforward
that I think
there's some ideological implication.
Well,
explain it to him real quick.
It may be.
And then you can.
It may be, in fact, that the problem is that it doesn't make sense to me because it requires people to be so absurdly stupid that doesn't make sense to me. And I suppose I should realize that.
people can be that absurd and stupid.
People meaning the people in the White House
who
allegedly did that.
I mean, the story that I think we're getting off topic, but I'll go with it as long as nobody's upset. The story that I get is somebody wanted to punish Wilson, so they outed his wife as an undercover CIA agent, thus ruining her career and either putting her at risk or intimidating other potential whistleblowers. Now, I can understand how you'd want to intimidate potential whistleblowers. That's what governments do. The mechanism for doing that, which consists, I guess, of a leak to Robert Novak about somebody being a CIA operative, from which Novak now is sort of backpedaling, just struck me as a truly bizarre way. If somebody said that it was like the Ernest Fitzgerald story, where you fire this woman, I don't care how you do it, get rid of her.
But she can't do her job anymore, so in essence she is fired.
Well, but she's not. I mean, that's what's weird. Because the problem with her, but the problem with her doing her job is the problem the White House has. I mean,
you don't have the vengeance. Lobe in your
brain. Well, maybe I don't. That may be my complete blind spot in this,
right.
And that may be the part that I really don't get.
My being a worse person may allow me to understand that.
But, you know, sort of the bigger question beyond this was, you know, do I have a responsibility to have an opinion about stuff? And, you know, I feel like I have a responsibility to honestly say what my opinion is. I don't feel I necessarily have a responsibility to have an opinion, and there are plenty of things on which I don't have an opinion or on which I have an opinion that I'm not confident in. And that actually is probably really where it was in the plane. My gut on that from the very beginning said, this is crap, there's nothing to this, it is yet another attempt to blow up a scandal out of something that's not a scandal. That's really what my gut said. And the reason I didn't go with that was because I said, but I don't feel like I have enough of a handle on it.
How's
I'm not
confident about that now?
I don't know. I actually am not persuaded that this is such a big deal, though nobody likes my idea, so I've been repeating it enough, which is that if it's